Well, welcome to another episode of Fukin Conversation. I'm really excited today. I have Kira Brandt Burkhoff with me. She's currently at UBC doing her doctorate. And prior to that, she did her Master's of Education at the University of Ottawa. The title of her thesis was, "But How Does This Help Me? Rethinking Reconciliation and Teacher Education." I've got so many questions for Kira, and it's been a while since I've spoken to her. And so welcome, Kira. Welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you, Nick. I'm good. I'm good. It's an early morning in Vancouver for me here, but doing well.
Well, and what has it been like out in Vancouver? My brother lives there, and I get to talk to him, and he seems a lot of people are staying home, even though there were some points where we saw a lot of people going out in Vancouver and the early outbreak, the long-term homes in terms of COVID-19. But I'm just wondering how things are there right now with the nice weather that you've been getting. And I understand from our conversation today that things are a little grayer there. But how are things in light of COVID-19 there?
Had only a few days of real sunshine, and on those days, everyone's flocking to the beaches, understandably so. But for the most part, my husband and I've been here for 3 years now, and I've been really proud, I think, to be part of the Vancouver community and watching our very quick and, I think, very serious response to pandemic measures, and I think taking it really seriously. So we're staying home. We're keeping our distance. Kind of the general rule of thumb is that the wingspan of an eagle of 2 meters distance in between you and strangers when you're outside. It's been, I think, the gray weather has worked in our favor to just stay home.
Mm. I should have, and maybe it wasn't a proper introduction, I should have also stressed that you're also a Mohawk woman. I have experienced the your stare and the stare down and from Tayendanega, and you must be missing home and your community, and so how have you been staying in touch, and what's going on in Tayendanega and in relation to COVID-19 and this time of year?
Definitely. It's been really difficult for a variety of reasons. I mean, the move away from home has been challenging, and I think more challenging than I anticipated. Of course, I was born and raised in Tyndonega, and when I finished high school at 17, I moved to Ottawa, you know, experienced a culture shock of sorts, but kind of found my own legs of living in the city, but really, I think not really understanding what a privilege it was to be so close to home at the same time. For post-secondary at the time, I mean, you're a drive away from home, even just to spend the weekend back home and to still feel that sense of connection. So moving out to Vancouver with my husband, I think, really presented a lot of those challenges of not only being away from family, but of land, and really having to relearn and renew, I think, my sense of responsibility of, yes, I'm a Haudenosaunee woman, but I'm an uninvited guest here on Coast Salish territories. So it was a really big learning curve, and I hope that it's informed my thinking and my teaching when I have particularly settler teacher candidates, for all of us to relearn of what is this, what does this look like, and what are our responsibilities here as guests. So that was an important learning curve for myself, and then just really heightened by this, I think, this homesickness with the pandemic of that I can't come home. I can't come home even if I wanted to. And I mean, Anton and I could hop in a car and attempt the drive across the country, but feeling like there's a community in need, and I think at times my family in need, and I can't be there. But it has brought, I think, some unexpected benefits in that so many of our teachings, of our ceremonies, and of our conversations that happen in person are now happening virtually. So I've been able to participate in some different teachings and to hear our language and to, you know, feel like everyone else is just a few kilometers away and I'm a few hundred kilometers away, but it almost feels irrelevant aside from the time difference. So that's been a very small gift that I don't take lightly, to be able to, I think, renew that sense of connection and of what it means to be an Ongwehome person.
And you spoke about having to navigate going to school within your community and then having to leave home and go to post-secondary. And then now, even though you're not able to physically be within the community, you're able to touch base virtually in relation to learning some of the teachings. And like you said, like in Vancouver, which is as a guest on someone else's traditional territories and land. And I'm just wondering, how did you navigate your understanding in relation to the current teachings that you're having now and this specific time of year? And I don't, we're kind of in this in-between space, at least in Ottawa, between what I would say is kind of coming out of the spring bloom in relation to summer. How have you been thinking about that in relation to a Haudenosaunee worldview or philosophy? Mm-hmm. How is that? How did you negotiate that also in relation to the educational system that, or systems that you've experienced, whether that's K-12 or K-13? And I don't know if it was for you K-12 or K-13. I think K-12, if I'm guessing correctly, and then university.
Definitely. I think it's really interesting, Nick, of drawing the parallels and even just attending to seasonal movements and in our teachings. So for us, traditionally, I mean, winter is our time of rest. When you slow down, of when we have ceremonies and socials and songs that are exclusively reserved for the wintertime, because it's harsh and it's a time of grief for some of us, and of thinking of loved ones, and of allowing that softness and that rest, both for us and for the earth. And so coming into spring, it's that time of renewal. We have our strawberry ceremony and our seed ceremony. It's returning to not to a life as usual, but that bringing that freshness back into that, breathing that life back into ourselves. And so being confronted with, I think, with the COVID-19 reality that we're living in, it's really kind of interrupted that, and yet responding to crisis and adaptation is something that we know. That we know from our stories that, I mean, historical epidemics and pandemics of the past don't feel so far away from us, when our oral histories really keep the past very living and very immediate. And so it's something that I think responding to this grief of sorts, and in your conversation with Jennifer a few weeks ago, she spoke to thinking about the grief that we're experiencing and the loss of from COVID-19 in many ways is similar to processes of colonization for us. And so I think it's just kind of, yes, if things are different, we're going to have to adapt. And that's just the reality that we're living in, and pulling together as a community, pooling resources, putting our elders first, thinking of community before the self, not in terms of sacrifice, but it's just our responsibility is to think of the whole and of the collective. It's very innately Indigenous. So returning to our teachings and our practices at this time, I think brings us a sense of comfort and again, of perhaps of like renewal that we needed in the spring, but it just takes on a different face at this time. And thinking about education, I mean, virtual distance learning has been a reality for many of our northern and isolated communities, but even this return to land, spending time with family and really embracing this new slowness that we've been confronted with is, I think, a real opportunity for us to rethink the necessity of K-12, I mean, not even the necessity, but the busyness of K-12 schooling and of filling our time. It allows, again, for this kind of return that many of our prophecies have spoken of. We're living in a time of our prophecies. This is what some of our knowledge keepers have been saying over the last few weeks. And I think as I really kind of internalize that, it's an interesting time to be living.
The term that you just made reference to at the end of what you just said, the concept of return, I see that really present in the works that you sent me. So you sent three pieces that were part of your comprehensive exam, which I really enjoyed reading. And I think the students in the course and others who get a chance to read them, I'll really appreciate it, especially doctoral students, to see the processes that and concepts and the way in which you're taking them up. And I also had a chance to read your dissertation proposal. And again, I learned so much. I learned more, I think, in relation to the work that you're doing and how you're thinking about it through reading those three pieces that I've probably learned through our conversations that we've just had when we get together. And so I thank you for that. And the one kind of narrative or story that you come back to is this leaving home and going back, and this sense of being a stranger. And you talk about this concept of stranger. You make reference to Suzanne Dion's work in terms of the perfect stranger, and how in teacher education, settler Canadian students who for the most part, and at least in my experience, have been from a white middle-class families, and in relation to trying to learn different Indigenous perspectives, histories, and current issues, there's this sense of being the perfect stranger that Suzanne Dion takes up. But you also recognize your own sense of estrangement and stranger in relation to whether that's when you went over to New Zealand and had the opportunity to work with teacher candidates over there as part of your research, and now at UBC and, of course, at Ottawa U. And so I was just wondering, how are you thinking about that, the concept of estrangement and stranger from your own perspective in relation to you living in Vancouver, but then also in trying to work through that with teacher candidates and teacher education?
Well, I started off with, in my proposal, reflecting on a time of spearing fish with my dad down at the Point, which is a very special place to my family, and I think to many Ongoy Hawaiian in Tyndonega. It was funny, if it was a story that sat with me, that kept bringing me back. You need to share this story. It has some kind of role in your research. And I'm like, I have no idea what I can draw from this. But one day I just started writing, and I finally got it out. And I think it actually continues to hold different layers of meaning. But so Dad and I were out fishing one night at the Point, or spearing rather, and you do that at dusk or in the early evening when it's dark. And so when it's dark and you have a small flashlight, you really rely on your other senses, and especially listening for the fish as they're starting to feast for the night and jumping and splashing about, and they'll let you know where they are. And so we're listening for the splashes, and there's just this constant just whopper of a fish, as Dad said, jumping out of the water. But we can't see it for the life of us. We just continue to hear these splashes. So we're going around the Point very slowly, searching for this mammoth of a fish that's waiting for us. But no matter where we look, we can't for the life of us see it. And finally, almost an hour in, we get to this log that's sticking out of the water. And we shine the flashlight over, and it's the eyes of a beaver staring back at us, smacking his tail on the ground. Dad and I just had to call it a night at that point, because we've just been trailing a beaver for the better part of an hour. We had a bit of a laugh, but we went home empty-handed. And so my dad knew those waters better than anyone else I've ever known. That's been it's part of our community. It's been traditional hunting and fishing territories for generations, and we know those waters intimately. And yet that night it was a stark reminder of we don't. That's not our home. That's beaver's home, and for the pickerel, and that's their space. And that there's reminders for us to ask ourselves, whose waters do we stand in? And so for myself, it's not only thinking about, again, this renewal to land and territory, and I think allowing space to surprise us in many ways, but thinking more broadly about in what ways can we make the familiar strange and make the strange familiar, and what opportunities does this hold for us in education for both settler and Indigenous peoples to rethink whose territories are we standing in, or whose waters do we stand in? Thinking about Duane Donald's work of on whose terms do we speak? So thinking about these educative possibilities for estrangement and of homecoming, whatever that looks like. And so for myself, that homecoming is very visceral. I have a very confident sense of home and place and connection to land. But for many settler visitors and guests on these territories, home is a little more elusive. And so not that it's necessarily a focus on thinking about home and concepts of that, but a homecoming of returning to what we thought we knew, and this transformed and renewed sense of being And it was Hongyu Wang's work that really transformed how I can think about this homecoming, not only for myself. It's very evident as I draw on Kareri and as I draw on Haudenosaunee teachings in my research, but thinking about the broader implications that this can have for our systems of Indigenous education in Canada.
You made reference to that sense of estrangement when in the piece that you describe your travels over to New Zealand to do some research over there and your time at MRI. And I really appreciated the concepts that you drew on in relation to learning there. But you do comment on at first feeling that sense of being a stranger over in New Zealand, but then there was a bit of familiarity. And I did a little bit of research on, and I'm probably not going to say this right or do justice. And if Ruth Kane's listening, she'll be like, Nick, what is going on with you? But Tangata Whenua. And I went on and looked, and it has different meanings as a verb and a noun. And so I'll read them here. For verb, it says, if learning the language begins when children are little, those children will speak Maori and the language will be natural to them. Another verb that this phrasing means is this tree has become naturalized in these islands. And the last one, which I was thinking about in relation to your work, it's the local people, host Indigenous people, people born of the Whenua, i.e. of the placenta and of the land where the people's ancestors have lived and where their placenta are buried. And to me, that's just such a powerful imagery in terms of thinking about the placenta in relation to the land and people's ancestors. And so I got that sense in terms of that work. Yeah, so I'm interested because you make reference to that concept in one of the works that you take up. And how has that informed how you're thinking in relation to your own philosophical approach to curriculum studies? And I mean, there's a story for sure in terms of your dad. And to me, that's kind of, in many ways, like a trickster story, just when you think you've got it. So the beaver reminds you, you haven't placed the trick on you. And I think to be so open to that. And maybe that's, you know, for me, that's like a better story than the teacher candidates that feel like in the work that you're doing with them, that they, in order to address Indigenous issues and perspectives or philosophies, that the sense that they feel that they need to have it. Right? Like that you can have that. In any case, I'm really interested in your time in New Zealand and that one example that you share in your piece in relation to how that's informed the kind of work that you're doing now.
Certainly. I think, thinking back to when I was drawing on that experience of New Zealand, what has always kind of stuck with me was being on the Marae and sense of, discomfort. It's I think, anxiety inducing in many ways of that newness of not only travel, but especially really being a very stark guest in someone else's home, literally. And so hearing Te Reo Māori and not being terribly familiar with protocols and practices that happen in there, I mean, it is that discomfort is very palpable. But in many ways as well, it was hearing language speakers being proud to speak their language, thinking about the role of spirit and of ancestors being very immediate in our relationships and what it is that we do. And it's just, I found that the more time that I'm spending there, the more that this very kind of intangible sense of home, perhaps in a way, was very real for me. And so I start to relax. And although I had no idea truly what was going on a cultural level, when it comes to ceremony, it's something you feel, perhaps more than you can understand or articulate at the time. And so this kind of familiarity was became very apparent for me as the 2 days on the Marae took place. However, I was in the room and it's sharing this experience with primarily settler teacher candidates, some of whom were from Canada, many international students, so Canadians being included, but many local New Zealand teacher candidates too. And so aside from the New Zealand teacher candidates that were familiar with some of the Te Reo Māori or the Māori language, scanning the room as I feel more and more comfortable, you're just seeing these eyes staring back at you that are far from feeling very, very comfortable. And I don't know if they ever really let their guard down. It was this very obvious sense of estrangement and of discomfort and of tension. When I conducted my research later and speaking to these teacher candidates, I mean, it was a very transformative experience for them, for some of them being their first experience with Indigenous peoples and Indigenous practices. And as I began to kind of unpack that, I mean, it's thinking about the role of culture and of language. I mean, the language itself and the words that we might not be very familiar with can kind of be a very superficial level of discomfort, not that the power of the language itself. I mean, the language revitalization and the words of, for those who understand, that carries immense power to speak those words of our ancestors. But I'm just more talking about the experience of being in someone else's home. It's something that I'm familiar with of being in the longhouse. That it's something much more personal when you can make these connections with spirit and with ancestors. But even that concept alone is very strange for non-Indigenous teacher candidates to think about the role of spirit and relationships with ancestors. So thinking about the possibilities of estrangement and how transformative this is for not only non-Indigenous but Indigenous peoples as well. What role can language play in this? What role can ceremony and these experiences that aren't really demanded of us when we talk about it in a classroom? And so, I mean, we know the transformative power of experiential learning, certainly, but it's just, I mean, thinking about Dewey, that not all experiences are educative. And so if we start with a very Indigenous concept, for myself, it's drawing on Haudenosaunee teachings and Haudenosaunee way of beings by starting with the Indigenous. What possibilities can this hold for us to really have this, again, renewal of self, of relationship to self, with others, with land, and hopefully, I mean, within educational sense, what possibilities does this hold for us to have a stronger sense of Indigenous education and relationship to Indigenous education?
What you just shared there also reminds us of the power of curriculum in the schools, like K-12, and in many ways, how it teaches us to forget those relationships to land, and especially in urban centers. And I'm not saying this is for everyone, but the way in which the curriculum might be taken up or compartmentalized into different subject areas, at least in terms of what I see my kids' experience, and I'm not taking anything away from the amazing educational opportunities the teachers are providing, but just the structure of the provincial curriculum and the way in which it's taken up in a classroom doesn't necessarily lend itself to what you're stressing in relation to these experiential opportunities in relation to place with elders, ceremonial protocols in relation to how you address and talk to each other. I know, at least for the teacher candidates that I've been able to travel up to Kittagong Zibi, there's definitely a difference in terms of their lived experience of the kind of curriculum that they invited to be part of up there at the cultural center that's different, that takes place in the classroom. You know, just going back to your work, you speak to that about this kind of discomfort and that. And I find, like, students, they have this, as you say, this anxiety prior to going up there. But once they get up there and start talking to elders and see that they're, like them, they're human beings, are open to having this kind of a different kind of relationship with them. But what was powerful and what you wrote, you said multiple teacher candidates recall the impact of the statement from one of the Pakia instructors who stated, how you feel on the Marae today is how your Maori students may feel in your classroom every day. And that sense of anxiety and fear. And so I thought that was powerful statement that you said. And coming back to your other piece where you're looking at, okay, so if we're doing this work with teacher candidates, it seems to me that you at UBC, you've had the opportunity to work with teacher candidates who are going out to do their practicum and they've looked to you on and a mentorship capacity to try to better understand how they might approach in terms of taking up Indigenous issues in the classroom if they're interested and committed to doing that as part of the, I would always say it should be beyond the 94 calls to action and truth and reconciliation. This is something that we should be committed to beyond that. Like, it's not just because that policy has been put out by the federal government that we're committed to do that, or it's policy in Ontario Provincial Ministry of Education documents. But you say this, as I've argued elsewhere, however, there is nothing inherently safe about Indigenous education for either Indigenous or non-Indigenous peoples. Indigenous teachers operate within marginalized and colonized systems that undermine Indigenous identity and knowledge systems, and non-Indigenous teachers are expected to confront ancestral and racialized identities in order to participate ethically within Indigenous education. Hence, what is asked of educators and learners alike is unsafe in many respects. So yeah, I'm wondering, could you maybe share your thinking on that, and having worked with teacher candidates in that capacity, how has that been?
Certainly. I mean, the notion of the deconstructing the myth of safe space, of a turn to ethical space, really began in my master's. And I find it's a very helpful framing for us to really kind of lay everything out on the table when it comes to our first few days of Indigenous education with my teacher candidates. For many of them, they're very hungry by the time they come to our classes to have this Indigenous education experience. Depending on the grade levels, it could be anywhere over 3 months, or for our secondary teacher candidates here, it's only over 4 weeks. So there's a lot to really not only learn, but unlearn and deconstruct in many ways, starting with this idea of, you know, trigger warnings and of safe space and of these very well-intentioned processes that we sometimes rely on when it comes to difficult knowledge in the classroom. Initially I was very skeptical, and now I find it really just needs to be deconstructed in our classrooms of safe space can neither be guaranteed, nor should it perhaps even be expected in an Indigenous education context. As you read there, Nick, thinking about for Indigenous peoples, for myself, not only as an Indigenous woman and as the instructor of this class, but even for any Indigenous students that I might have in my classes, putting our knowledge systems and our languages and our histories of trauma and of contemporary realities out on the table. I mean, it's literally, you're discussing my family and my land, and it's just this constant reopening of wounds at times, that it's extremely emotionally and spiritually damaging every single day that we are in that classroom. But then we still have to stand up there and be professional. And I mean, I love what I do because I bring so much of myself to it. But for students to tell me that it's too emotional, or it's too hard, or it's too heavy, I think really needs some attending to, in that it's heavy, but it's necessary, it's important work. So on the one hand, for Indigenous peoples, there's certainly nothing safe about that. And then likewise, for my settler students, I have the utmost respect of what I'm asking them to do is to take this very introspective reflection on, how do I understand Canadian history? How do I understand my family, who perhaps sacrificed so much to come here a few years ago, or perhaps sacrificed so much and has now claimed stake in this, you know, Canadian identity and Canadian history? And so I'm now asking them and telling them what they thought they knew about this land and about this relationship with Indigenous peoples has very much been it's more than misconstrued. It requires this very real, again, uncomfortable look at what we thought we knew of, again, this estrangement with our relationship to Canadian identity. And so, again, it's very unsafe. It's very unstable. And so with that, now that we know this, it's not a free for all, but it's okay. So how can we begin to speak across these divides? How can we begin to attend to our own learning, but now also embrace new perspectives and a new way of our relationship to land and to Indigenous peoples? And so with that, it's a turn to Duane Donald's work and Willie Ermine's work on ethical space, in that I honor who you are. I honor your ethics and the experiences, the histories that you bring as a human, as a person. And likewise, you need to be where it's a reciprocal relationship of likewise honoring mine. And so it's not about consensus or assimilation of ideas. It's about embracing that tension and leaving that room for tension to really authentically grapple with and once again create relationship with one another.
The point that you brought home in what you just shared it really at the start is that, and this is a tension for me, and I continue to try to unlearn the ways in which I've been doing it and trying to figure out how to collaboratively do it better is as you said, yourself and your family have lived these histories and you continue to live the intergenerational impacts that settler colonialism as a system has created across what some people call Canada. I'm sure in terms of your community, your relationship is different as nation to nation and how you refer to yourselves. And it's a very hard concept for settler Canadians to understand that nation to nation relationship, even in terms of in my former capacity as director of teacher education, a lot of the initiatives that we had in place they were propelled by the commitment to one aspect of the historical violence of settler colonialism being the Indian residential schooling system. And there's so many other examples of that violence that have taken place. But most of the things that we create in teacher education have been geared towards settler Canadians. And from that perspective, and there's like this hunger we want to learn about as opposed to unlearning their own implication, as Dwayne Donald would say, in this system. And then also my fear is and Anita Tanasco, who's the director of Kitigansi, we said, hey, not all of the stories that we live and our lived experiences are about these, you know, Eve Tuck's made reference to this and others about these damaged centered narratives. But there's, you know, we're still here. Like there's this resilience that we've gone and we made so many contributions to the way in which we now live. So for me, that's one of the things that I'm trying to reconcile, if you will, is if it's geared towards settler Canadians, these educational curriculum that we might put forth in teacher ed, I'm always like with more and more First Nation, Inuit, and Métis students now coming to the programs, it's not the same. And then having to sit in class and listen to students ask these questions, you know, you have to listen to the microaggressions and the violence and the questions that they're asking that you actually have lived. So I don't know if you've had to deal with that at UBC in relation to the classes or students you've worked with and what your thinking is in relation to that.
I think returning to your first point there, Nick, of as Anita said, it's not always heavy. I mean, when I think of what it means to be a Haudenosaunee woman, it's our humor and it's our food and it's our dances and it's our way of bringing back our ancestral teachings while also embodying them, because for us, our language and our teachings, it's not so much this romanticization and fixation on ceremony and on ritual, but it's of living in a good way and being simply a good person. But it's not as simple as that, but the concept is. I think it's really important that we're bringing back that life and that humor to our Indigenous education classes. I even find it of working with our teachers, our in-service teachers here in Vancouver. We recently started a book club with some educators at a local school. We read Wob Rice's Moon of the Crested Snow and thinking about an apocalyptic narrative within Indigenous communities. And our next book will be Motorcycles and Sweetgrass by Drew Hayden Taylor, of bringing back that humor and that life to Indigenous education. And it's not always these warm, fuzzy, feel-good narratives. It's very much held in tension with the legacies of settler colonialism. It's very much at the forefront of what it means to be an Indigenous person. And yet that's not the only thing.
How do you deal with the tension of, you know, developing a curriculum for your course and thinking it through in relation to your own lived experience and potentially what I see is the mindset in teacher ed programs. It's this redressing of the present absence of Indigenous perspectives, histories, and contemporary issues in some of the courses, but very much focused on settler Canadian future teacher candidates as opposed to First Nation, Métis, and Inuit teacher candidates. And when you have those students, which we are having more and more of those students, how one negotiates the way in which you're thinking about those courses in ways that don't mitigate the, because I won't say don't, because I that might be an impossibility, but mitigate the reproduction of the kind of epistemic and ontological violence that can take place in the courses for those students by going through the topics that you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. For myself, it can be a constant dance of balancing the expectations of Indigenous education that the settler teacher candidates are bringing to my classes. Wanting a in many different respects, but the how to of I don't want to be racist and I just want to teach about this, or quite often this is irrelevant because I'm doing science education or math education. So it's navigating those expectations and negotiating those expectations at times, while also I think just bringing the humanity back to Indigenous education. Of why is it that we're having these conversations, and what is the power of having these conversations, you know, in a post RCAP, post TRC, Indigenous education landscape. And so when it comes to navigating those expectations and sometimes those the resistance that I experience with settler teacher candidates, it can't be clouded over by, I think, the really rich experiences and conversations that I have with many settler teacher candidates who are eager and who take this work seriously, and that I feel like it's a small but sometimes vocal minority of resistance from teacher candidates. And so it's really leaning into perhaps they're just not ready, and that there's some great work that can be done with those teacher candidates that are perhaps at a different place in their journey of reconciliation and in decolonizing their teaching practices. And then it's on a completely kind of separate conversation. It then is, you know, creating those relationships with my Indigenous teacher candidates, who again bring their own diversity of experiences, some of whom are reclaiming their own sense of Indigenous identity, feeling a very visceral lack of connection to either community and to teachings and to language. And so in many ways, recognizing that my classroom can be a space for their own learning and for their own coming to their relationship with their indigeneity. And then I have another spectrum of Indigenous teacher candidates who, like myself, perhaps left their community and they have a very strong sense, and they know exactly that they're going to go back into their community, recognizing how can I join them on a journey to really developing their leadership capacities, and preparing them for the racisms and settler colonialism that they will be confronted with sometimes daily in their classrooms or in their schools, and yet recognizing that they're also experts in their own communities. And so providing that space for them to be able to share their expertise and to claim that space for themselves in my class, and likewise in their future teaching practices. So it's many different levels of relationships that I'm not only navigating in terms of, you know, person to person relationship, but the complexity of positionalities and again of expectations and where they are respectively in this journey towards. I think ultimately it's relationship with land is what it comes back to me for. It's once we recreate and understand relationship with land, then we can unpack treaty and history and sense of place.
Now you're working on you just successfully, and you must be so happy, you just successfully defended your dissertation proposal. And I have to say, like, you've been a superstar student, and I'm so lucky to know you, because you received SHRC funding for your MA, and then you received more funding to support your travel to go do your research and study in New Zealand, and then now have SHRC funding for your doctoral studies. So kudos to you, because those aren't easy to get, as you know and others know. And it's important research that's being funded by the federal government. So, well, you know, I think it's important and crucial. And what you've proposed in your dissertation, it's titled, let's see if I get this, Ganin Stohare, Educative Possibilities of Indigeneity, Estrangement, and Homecoming. And you're really leaning, and I'm interested, you're leaning on what you've referred to as indigeneity and autobiography, but also really informed by Carrere. So I'm just wondering, how are you thinking and crossing what you've referred to in your prior work in your comps as these different borderlands, and how when you travel to Europe and understanding, like according to the Schengen Agreement, this the kind of lack of, once you're in Europe, this lack of sense of border, this borderless place, but there are borders when you shift from one place to the other in terms of culture expectations. And how are you navigating that in relation to drawing on the different ways of knowing and being in a quote unquote Western university system or settler colonial system? And then in relation to how you're conceptualizing indigeneity and autobiography in your proposal and the current work that you're doing.
Yeah. Definitely. So for myself, when it comes to Ganin Stohare, which is corn soup, it's really just evolved into my own, like leaning into this Haudenosaunee methodology. What is a Haudenosaunee education system grounded in? In what ways is it transformative? And so returning to just our teachings and our practices, the knowledge is there, the methodology is there, and it's what our ancestors have always understood. And it was my grandmother who I lie corn with and have made many, many bowls of corn soup with. She was a teacher for most of her life, and she was the one who told me about listening to the teachings embedded in lying corn, and that moment when you put in lye and you're putting in the corrosive agent and you boil white corn with this lye, and you do multiple rounds of boiling and washing and rinsing, and you're waiting for that moment when literally the corn pops in a way and it's forever transformed. And so dried white corn has very little nutritional value. It's in that lying process that the proteins are released, and the corn it's sustained our communities for generations. And so it's that lied corn and that transformed corn that we can then make corn mush with and cornbread and of course corn soup. And so for myself, what is that transformative pop for all of us? And so even going back to the entire process of how we set an intention to grow corn, and setting an intention for myself is having a clear purpose, articulating my research question and my direction, but also offering tobacco, understanding what it is that I'm asking for and seeking, and recognizing my roles and responsibilities with that. And then next, in order to even think about corn soup, we have to prepare the field, and then we sow the seeds and we nurture those that relationship with land, and we draw on old teachings and new teachings, because I have the teachings that my grandparents have, but I might also read something new online. And so for myself, it's the process of conceptualizing how one makes good corn soup, and you're relying on intuition, you're relying on traditional teachings, you're open to new knowledge and new learning, but it's ultimately working towards that moment of lying the corn and that transformative pop. But there's no guarantees that all the corn is you know going to transform, and it's dangerous in many respects as well. So it's dangerous without guarantees and yet very necessary. And then the last step of once we've lied the corn, and in my methodology, it's then serving the soup. And so how is it that my research, how do I cook with the community in mind? How does my research benefit Ongwe Hongwe people? And likewise, that the curricular landscape of Canada, of thinking about and attending to Haudenosaunee concepts of education. And so with that, I'm not only drawing on traditional teachings, but leaning into Carrere, so that I can also kind of have a turn to Indigenous autobiography, which is a field really kind of in the making in many ways, which is very ironic because the Indigenous peoples who occupy the space of Indigenous autobiography are saying, this is what our ancestors have always done. There's nothing new about this. We have always had the practice of sharing stories and having a very clear sense of, this is who I am, this is where I come from, these are my people, and this is our story. And yet the field in particular of autobiography has been very exclusive of white narratives, again, prioritizing the written storytelling over orality. And so it's just, it's an exciting time to be an Indigenous person working in autobiography, and that it's a reclaiming of the field in many ways and pushing back and pushing the boundaries of even the concept of auto and autobiography. This isn't my story. This is a story of a people and of culture and of recognizing my place in the communal. And so work within Indigenous autobiography plays a significant role in my research, and then is allowing me to attend to this gun and stohare or this corn suit methodology in many ways, and bringing this to the academy so that it has a platform, and not that it's needed. Our people know these teachings, but for myself, it's reconciling who I am as an emerging scholar and also as an Ongwehome woman, and that they're not two separate identities, but very complex in many ways. And with my partner, who's an immigrant himself and is non-Indigenous, I mean, there's so many different ways in which our contemporary Indigenous identities are very complex and are navigating many different worlds. And yet, in for myself, it's not different worlds. I don't have my feet in different worlds. It's simply my contemporary experience, my lived experience of what it means to be a present-day Ongwehome woman. And I think that my experience is not unique in many respects, that there's many people who have come before me, who have trailblazed this before me of being Indigenous in the academy. And I hope that many more come after. And so it's really just embracing this platform for both Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples to begin to have these conversations of what is an Indigenous methodology, and what I hope in turn to offer is what is an Indigenous theory, and that we don't need to rely on critical race theory and turning to these other frameworks that, yes, sometimes they help us to articulate and really kind of dig our teeth into something that we've never considered before. But at the same time, our theories can come from our own cultures and their own particularities. And so by offering a Haudenosaunee theory in many ways, I'm hoping to push curriculum studies and push curriculum theory, have the complexities of offering Indigenous theory, Indigenous frameworks. And it's now time for you to understand my language, literally and figuratively, both in terms of understanding the concepts in an Indigenous worldview, but also for myself embedding Ganyingeha in the Mohawk language into this, to allow people to stumble over our language and to consider our worldview. And so for myself, it's what I love about curriculum studies and curriculum theory is it's always been a diverse group of thinkers who collectively were in the common pursuit of what knowledge is of most worth. And so by having that entry point, it's a very honest place for me. And Bill Pinar, my supervisor, really encourages me and arguably pushes me more to return to who are you as an Ongwehome person, and let's just start from there and to literally tell your story from there.
The imagery of you working with your grandmother in a process that is, from the way in which you describe it, dangerous in terms of working with the lion as a corroding agent, and so much like in terms of the relationship between that story and the promise without promise of it turning out. So there's this sense of hope that things will work out. And even in your description, like, there's no magic formula. It's done when it's done, and you'll know when it's done because it'll tell you when it's done.
Yeah.
In many ways, like, that can be for me, at least for me, and the difficulty of autobiographical research is, And especially in terms of doing the process of Carrere and the temporal movements between past narrative snapshots that you free associate and put forth in relation to imagining the future, reimagining the future, and then coming back to the present. It takes me forever to write those pieces or think through them and theorize them and live them, because it's like you say, you know, when you're done is when they're done, and there's no promise, and you're trying to make sense of what they might teach you. So I really appreciate and love the imagery of you and your grandmother. And in many ways, you make reference to it, that it's more than just the auto, and you put forth this term, commune bio oratory or community life speaking, in terms of the wearing of Wong and Redder. And so that really resonates with me in terms of the work that you're trying to do, and how you're troubling the kind of, hey, we've been doing this work forever, but only these scholars have been recognized in relation to doing this kind of research, while there's other scholars that are encouraging lots of different members of different communities that have not had that kind of space to amplify their voices in terms of what they've already been saying within a university setting, as one example. So I want to thank you for that and sharing those other stories. The one with your father, it made me laugh so much, because I'm going to have similar stories of chasing, when you're a kid and your cat, you're like, oh, I got a big one. Like, they caught, we always used to say caught Oscar, which was a reference to like another log, like you're reeling in a big log that you think this big fish that's giving you. So what's next then for you in terms of the coming months? Like, I know you've finished, you've successfully defended this. So what's going to be part of your lived curriculum for the next few months in light of COVID-19?
Staying home and allowing that space for not only reflection, but just a lot of writing. Returning to my methodology as we harvest the corn and we're in the fields. And for me, that's really an engagement with literature, with teachings, and thinking about the different threads of conversation, so as to interweave and problematize estrangement and homecoming within a Haudenosaunee methodology. For me, it's I guess I'm kind of at that stage of spending time in the field, spending time with the corn, and thinking about when it's going to be ready for harvest, when I feel like I've reached, it's at its peak, and I feel well-versed in the conversation. And at that time, it'll then be a harvesting of the literature, in a sense, and of braiding those concepts together. So for us, when we harvest in autumn, we then take the white corn and we braid it together and we hang it to dry over the winter. And then once it's ready, we can remove the kernel from the cob and get it ready for the lye. And then it'll be that transformative process. So for myself right now, really immersing myself in the conversation and recognizing when it's ready to be braided together and then kind of hung to dry, so to speak. So it's a lot of reading, it's a lot of reflection, but for myself, it's really just a lot of writing as well. And it's there's no kind of standard process for myself as to how I'm writing. It's quite organic, but it's really a lot of reflection and of forcing myself to capture those thoughts of as I'm reading, especially about Indigenous education. It's memories for myself are flooding back to oh my gosh, like I never really realized that we didn't listen to O Canada in the morning, and we didn't stand for that at our school. We had the Ohandagadiadekwa, which is the Mohawk Thanksgiving address. And so even reflecting on the impact that's had for myself and my own educational experience, and it's these little triggered times. So it's really providing some intentional space for that amidst all of this. I mean, it's a valuable time And I think Ted the other day in your conversation mentioned it's a valuable time to be a philosopher to give us that space to think at home and to think in the world and to lean into that slowness while also staying informed and recognizing that what a privilege it is, I think, for myself to be safe and to still feel productive and to still move forward in my work, and that my health and my position right now is an immense privilege, and I still have many responsibilities to support community and to support in the ways that I can. I think just doing what I can do right now, and that's staying home.
where home is right now. Well, yeah, staying exactly. Home, but you're so connected too, virtually to your home. And I love the way in which you talk about that. There is an intent. There's an intent that's related to a historical experience. There's an intent that's informed by community. There's an intent that's connected to land and the seasons, and even the way in which in your work you talk about the braiding of the three sisters and how each one relies on the other in order to nourish the community. And so this performance of braiding in relation to the corn, the beans, and the squash, in terms of that connection to land. I'm so excited to see how you take that up in relation to the process of lying corn and what might emerge. So I just wanted to thank you for that. And thank you for taking the time today. And I'm hoping that you'll come back, and once you're completed and have those additional stories and connections to your lived experiences back home, and whether that's in the past or right now in Vancouver, or even in the future, in a few months from now, who knows what's going to be in place, right, in terms of COVID-19. So Kira, I just thank you so much for joining me today on the podcast.
Oh, thank you, Nick. Oh, my pleasure. Truly. It's been the podcast in particular, I mean, has played a really significant role in my thinking in the evenings. I've really gotten into puzzles lately, so I'll put on the podcast and do my puzzle and the kinesthetic experience of having something to do with my hands, but allowing that space for me to be able to think about the conversations you're having with curriculum scholars whose work I draw on immensely. Jennifer and Ted and Dwayne, and starting off with Hongyu Wang. And it's just you'll have many citations in terms of my thinking from the podcast alone. So I thank you for this, Nick.
Well, thank you. And this has been probably the most exciting and thought-provoking learning experience so far in my career, is being able to sit down for an hour and talk to you about your thinking and your work. And so thank you for the joy of enabling me to do that.